This is an encore presentation of the full story. I'm Tom Kuser. Imagine being a goalie on the ice when you can't see the puck, or a forward on the hardwood and you use a wheelchair to get to the basket. It's real for athletes with different abilities through programs that help them get in the game. We begin with a new basketball team at Southern Connecticut State University in New Haven. This is an all-veterans wheelchair basketball team. It's co-ed, and it's the first of its kind in the Northeast. Paul Weiland is the program manager for SCSU's Institute of Adaptive Sports and Recreation. He's also a member of the team, and he joins us via Zoom to tell us more about the new team. Mr. Weiland, welcome to the full story.
Thank you, and thank you very much for having me.
Certainly. First, you manage the Adaptive Sports and Recreation Program at SCSU, as I mentioned. What are adaptive sports exactly?
So adaptive sports are kind of what it sounds to be, sports that have been adapted or adjusted to allow people of all abilities and function levels the opportunity to play sports and compete at whatever level they choose, at either a recreational or a competitive level. Basically, just taking any sport that you can think of and adapting it primarily for individuals with physical disabilities.
And that essentially is also what inclusive recreation refers to?
To a point, inclusive recreation also brings in a lot more of the idea of typical peers and individuals with special needs coming together to participate in sports and recreation. So the inclusive part speaks to the collaboration of all ability levels versus just adapting it for the individual with special needs.
I'd like to know a bit more about the program that you manage at SCSU. How does it create more opportunities for adaptive sports and inclusion recreation?
Well, first and foremost, the Institute for Adaptive Sports and Recreation is housed within our therapeutic recreation program here at Southern. And so one of the first things it does is it allows students going through our programs, whether it's therapeutic recreation, adaptive physical education, they're getting experience, number one, working with the population. So as they become professionals in the field, they're going to have the firsthand knowledge and be able to provide opportunities to their patients or whomever they're going to be working with in their fields. So it's also building for the future. But then within the Institute, we're providing opportunities for not only students on campus, because even students who are on campus can come to our programming, but also community members at large. For example, with the wheelchair basketball program, we have athletes from six different states that have shown interest in the team and have taken part in practices or our clinic that we had in September. So there's just a lot of different opportunities and chances for growth. And we also have a grant currently with the Veterans Association that is allowing us to partner with a variety of community partners to even provide programming that's not even on Southern's campus, but working with places like the Hospital for Special Care and Gaylord Hospital as well.
With team members, that's interesting, coming from so far and wide. How did the team become a team?
You know, that's a really great question. So one of our team members, Dennis Barbetti, and I'm going to feel bad, but I think I mispronounced his last name, but he is actually an individual who's originally from Connecticut and living in the DC area currently. And in September, we co-hosted an all-veterans wheelchair basketball clinic with the Paralyzed Veterans Association and the National Wheelchair Basketball Association here on Southern's campus. And the National Wheelchair Basketball Association just launched this all-veterans wheelchair basketball league. And so they casually asked, hey, since you're hosting this clinic, would you host a team? Because there's nothing in this region and we'd love to have a team. And they knew my background in wheelchair basketball. And Dennis overheard this conversation and he goes, hey, if you host a team, I'll drive 6.5 hours, 5.5 hours to practice. And I looked at him and I said, well, sir, thank you for your service and we're going to make a team.
Has it been a challenge to recruit members? I guess not with at least a couple of folks.
It is a challenge because not only in the veteran population, but in the adaptive sports world overall, there's a lot of misconceptions about who's eligible, why you would play this sport, those types of things. And then access to the athletes are always difficult as well, because with HIPAA restrictions and different things, even when I know where athletes or potential players might be, I can't have direct access to them. Quick personal story. I was born 3 months premature with cerebral palsy, and I grew up playing able-bodied football and didn't have any idea that adaptive sports existed till I went to college and found out I had walked onto one of only 8 campuses in the country that had a collegiate wheelchair basketball program. And the captains of the wheelchair basketball team literally cornered me in a hallway and told me I was playing the wrong sport. And from that point on, I became a 5-year letter winner, a 4-year captain, and I've been all over the country coaching and playing wheelchair basketball. And it all happened by accident. So that's why these opportunities that the Adaptive Institute is providing, not only for the athletes, but for the students within our programs to help get the word out about these sports, are so important. Because how much better or how much more experience would I have gotten if I got to start playing much younger in my life?
You anticipated my next question, which was, how did you get involved in wheelchair basketball? You've answered that. What college, by the way, was that?
So I am originally from South Dakota, and I was at Southwest Minnesota State University in Marshall, Minnesota.
The new team, and I know it's not yet named, but the new team is co-ed. Is that unusual?
Not necessarily within the idea of the institute, or excuse me, within wheelchair basketball. There is a lot of co-ed teams. Even if you look overseas at the professional ranks, there are women playing on men's teams. There is a separate women's division as well, and they will be hosting and holding their national tournament at the same time our Veterans League is hosting our national tournament in Alabama in April. So it's just a matter of building numbers and having enough numbers to build a team.
And do I understand correctly that the team is not necessarily exclusive to veterans in wheelchairers?
You do not have to be a full-time chair user to play wheelchair basketball. What's awesome about the Veterans League, as the National Wheelchair Basketball Association has set it up, is it's encompassing kind of the wounded warrior model, and therefore conditions such as PTSD and TBI and even low vision qualify you to play wheelchair basketball within this league, whereas otherwise you would have to have a permanent lower body disability that would prevent you from playing able-bodied sports. The whole concept is to truly provide opportunities to have these veterans get that sense of teamwork, camaraderie, and that sort of thing back that they may have lost after leaving the military.
Again, with your members coming from such distant places, how do you handle practice? That must be difficult to coordinate.
It is quite a challenge, but luckily, as part of the Institute for Adaptive Sports and Recreation, we're also supporting a local men's and women's co-ed wheelchair basketball team, the Connecticut Spokebenders. And so I bring that team to our veterans practices so that even if only one or two veterans come to practice on a given Thursday, they have a full team to practice against. And then to combat the other ideas of distance and travel, we will be scheduling out weekend practices where we'll be doing like a boot camp Saturday, where we'll reserve the gym for about 3-4 hours on a Saturday or even longer, depending on how many people can make the trip, and do kind of a boot camp style practice right before we go and compete.
You mentioned competition. How does that work? Is there a league set up, standings, that sort of thing?
So we are the sixth team of our kind within the new All Veterans League. That's part of the National Wheelchair Basketball Association. So we will definitely see all those teams at the national tournament in April. Given how far those teams are from us, we may not get the opportunity to compete directly against them in preparation for the national tournament. But luckily, there are co-ed and men's teams and even women's teams in the area that we can compete against, both in New York, Rhode Island, Massachusetts. So we'll be able to get competition in without having direct competition with other veterans teams.
How does the funding work to, for instance, transport people from one place to another, to, I guess, rent the buses or what have you?
So the simple answer to that is we're still working to figure all that out. Southern Connecticut State University has offered their support, both from a financial standpoint, but also from obviously a facility standpoint, and providing the wheelchairs and that different thing for people that don't have access to their own equipment. And then the New England Paralyzed Veterans Association has also pledged support to help with some of those costs. But that's an ongoing process. We're always looking for support and help, because as the team grows and as we compete more, the costs will inevitably keep rising. So we're always looking for support and help in a variety of ways, whether that's funding or people to come in and be equipment managers, mechanics, those types of things. We're always looking for support and guidance.
Is the equipment or the wheelchairs for the game different than what someone might think of as a standard wheelchair?
120%. A basketball wheelchair, a sports wheelchair, is designed to be lightweight, to be quick, to have a very tight turning radius, to support the athlete, to allow them to be as functional as they can in athletic competition. So they're very specialized. When you get measured for a chair, for your own personal chair, it's like getting measured for a tuxedo almost. It's down to the inches, because the tighter the chair is to your body and fits your body's requirements, both from a physical and a functional level, the better you can play. The difference between a sports wheelchair and what an average person would think as a day chair or an everyday chair, it would be the difference between Michael Jordan playing in a pair of Nikes versus playing in a pair of cowboy boots. And so having the right equipment allows you to play at a high level, and having the wrong equipment puts you at a very disadvantage before you even start.
Is there training involved then to get people used to the sports chair versus the standard chair? Because it, as you just described, it's very, very different.
Exactly. That is, we refer to that in the adaptive sports world as chair mechanics, not necessarily the mechanic of the chair or whether it works or not, but being able to handle the chair is considered chair mechanics. And that is the majority almost of a basketball practice, is getting used to your chair, being able to turn quickly, to start and stop on a dime, to be able to move at the right angles given the situation, whether offense or defense. So those types of things, and getting used to the chair, as you say, is a big priority in our practice form.
As far as the game itself, are there significant differences, rules and whatnot, between an adaptive basketball game and a non-adaptive game?
That's a beautiful question, and the best answer that I can give to that, and what makes me really proud of Adaptive Sports across the board, is that we do everything we can to parallel the sports as close as we can. So when you look at wheelchair basketball, generally speaking, we play women's college basketball rules. So the court is exactly the same length, the baskets are the same height. Nothing changes. The only rule change, because we run the same four quarters and that sort of thing, but the only basic rule change is there's no such thing as a double dribble. So if an athlete needs to put the ball down with two hands, they're allowed to do so. But then every two pushes, just like every two steps, they have to put the ball down. So there is traveling involved. And the only reason that that two-handed dribbling rule exists is because you may have someone with limited hand function. I actually played against a gentleman in college who had no hands, and he would dribble and shoot with his two arms that had no hands on them. So that adaptation is made. The second and final rule change is there's something called a personal advantage foul, which is assessed to someone who has use of their lower limbs that uses those limbs outside the chair to gain an advantage. So you'd be looking at someone that stands up to gain a height advantage within their chair, or maybe uses their foot to stop or something of that nature.
And what about the referee corps? You have special referees or
yes,
obviously that understand the rules.
Most of our referees also referee other sports at varying levels, but there is a special refereeing clinics and classes and tests, because while the game is played almost exactly the same way, the angles and where you look for fouls are different. Whereas in an able-bodied game, you're going to be looking for a lot of hand checking and body contact in the air. Our game is played, you know, at hip or lower level. You have to look down to call fouls. And so it's just a matter of learning the different angles.
What about the dynamic of the team? What's the feeling that you get when the members come together to practice or to play?
That's one of the proudest pieces of not only the Veterans Wheelchair Basketball Program, but the entire Institute of Adaptive Sports and Recreation here at Southern. We are truly building a sense of community, not only for the athletes and participants within the program, but the students, volunteers, coaches, everybody that takes part in what we do learns from the situation, whether it's the student learning how to work with the population, a participant succeeding in their chosen field of expertise, whatever it may be, everybody is learning, but we're learning together. And that's what makes this also impressive.
I understand that, again, as you mentioned, you formed the team. The team was formed just a couple of months ago, back in September, and you don't have a name just yet. But I was wondering, do you have any candidates in mind, possibilities for a team name?
So, again, I feel that I'm going to mess this up a little bit. But when we left the clinic in September, I gave Dennis a piece of homework, and I told him, well, if we're going to have a team, we got to come up with a name. And we are the Southern Connecticut State University Owls, so it should probably tie into that. And he did some research, and the most aggressive owl out there is called the Tiger Owl. And there is a military outfit called the Flying Tigers that is connected to everything that we do. So there is some discussion on how to tie all that together, but again, none of that is official yet at this point.
What's next for your team? I understand you're preparing for the national competition in April.
Yes, that is our end goal. Right now, we're working on solidifying our roster, building our exposure. That's why this conversation with you today is so important, to help get the word out to all veterans and their families across the area, to help fill out the roster. And then once we have that solidified, we'll be able to schedule the weekend boot camp style practices to strengthen our team camaraderie and just our game flow. And then we're going to be doing some fundraisers in the spring to get ready for the national tournament, and just looking to schedule games as well in between time. Right now, the focus is individual skill development and just finding and doing more outreach.
Paul Weiland is the program manager for Southern Connecticut State University's Institute of Adaptive Sports and Recreation, and he's the man behind a new veterans wheelchair basketball team at Southern. Thank you so much for spending time with us today. We appreciate it.
I appreciate you. Thank you very much.
And so what about hockey? Do you need to see well to face off in the ice rink? Let's find out how a team in Hartford, Connecticut handles that challenge. They are the Hartford Brailers, and they're one of 17 adaptive hockey programs for blind players in the country. Two of the Brailers are with us to talk about their approach to this rough-and-tumble game of hockey. Program organizer Keith Haley, he's also skating as a forward for the team, and Todd Sweet, also a forward for the Brailers. And they join us on Zoom. Gentlemen, welcome to The Full Story.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Certainly.
Yeah, great to be here.
Keith, if we could start with you, what are the visual abilities of the players?
We are made up of blind and visually impaired players, so not everyone is totally blind. It is the game of hockey. It's real hockey. So you need to be able to move the puck up and down the ice. So we have vision classifications. We rate people B1 through B4. B4 is considered visually impaired, and then B3 is legally blind, and the vision goes down from there. So a B3 has 10% vision or less. Those are typically your forwards to get the puck up and down the ice. B2s are 5% vision or less, and they're typically your defenders. So they can stay home a little bit more. They don't have to go the full length of the ice. And goalies, ironically, have to be totally blind. Those are your B1s. They're light perception to no light perception at all. And to level the playing field, the goalies also wear blindfolders just to make sure that they're not getting any sensation of light or anything of that nature. So those are the vision classifications, and that's how we play the game as far as moving the puck around the ice, because it is ice hockey. It's a fast-paced sport, and you got to be able to move that puck.
So as far as equipment, the rink size, the rules, how does the hockey game the Brailers play differ from a standard game?
There's two modifications. It's a standard rink. The gear is all the same. The goal is a foot shorter than a standard hockey goal. And that's because the goalies are totally blind. They typically play from their knees, and that keeps, and the puck's heavier. I'll get to the puck in a second, but the puck's a little heavier, so it keeps the shots down low. And, you know, if you had a full size net, you know, people could score top shelf, and it just kind of, again, levels that playing field for the goalie who has no vision. The biggest draw to blind hockey is the puck. And the reason I say that is because it's six times the size of a standard puck. It's made out of metal, and it's hollow with ball bearings inside. So when you shake it, it sounds like a cowbell, and it rattles, and you can hear it. Whenever we're on the ice, lots of little kids, if they've just got off their youth hockey game, you know, they're drawn to what that noise is. They're like, what are they playing with? And that goes for adults too. I mean, anyone that hears that puck, you know, it rattles, you can hear it. And that's actually how we track the puck, even those with low vision to no vision. And that's also how the goalies track where the puck is, you know, whether it's the left side of the rink or the right side of the rink. So what we do, one of the rules in blind hockey is once you enter the offensive zone, you have to complete one pass before you can shoot on net. Once that pass is completed, you'll hear a different toned whistle. We call it a pass whistle. And that alerts the goalie now that be ready for a shot. Because when you have no vision and you've got that big metal puck coming at you, it hurts no matter what. You know, it kind of, you know, it honestly hurts. You've got full pads on, but, you know, kind of rings your bell if you catch it in the head and you weren't ready for it. So that pass whistle lets them know that there's a shot that can be taken at any moment. And that's where our communication comes in with the goaltender, as well as everyone else on the ice, you know, whether the puck's on the left side of the rink, the right side of the rink, and that helps the goalie track it.
Officials are the ones with the whistles or the signals that tell the players that the puck has passed a certain line?
Correct. Once they get over the blue line and that pass is made, and it tells everybody, you know, if you're traveling in by yourself, it's kind of funny because you've been trained in regular hockey to just go for the guy with the puck. Mm. But in blind hockey, the trailer is actually the important guy, because that guy that just went into the zone with the puck can't do anything with it till he makes that one pass to his teammate before they can take a shot on net. So the important guy is the guy coming in after the guy with the puck.
Given the larger puck, does that affect the construction of a hockey stick? Is it bigger, heavier, or is it just a standard hockey stick?
Standard hockey stick. All the gear, you from the skate to the helmet, are all the same. The gloves. It's just a heavier puck. So it is, you know, there's not as much icing in blind hockey, because to send that puck down 200 feet is, you know, it usually loses some steam as it crosses center ice. I mean, it does happen.
Icing meaning someone knocks the puck from one end of the rink to the other.
Right. Yeah. It's such a heavier puck than you know, it's funny when we had a regular hockey puck on the ice recently, and I looked at it, I said, is that a regular puck? Cause I've been playing this for four years now with that big metal puck. And it looked to us like an Oreo compared to the larger size puck that we use now.
Where do you play your games, or your home games?
We play at a Newington Arena. And what we do locally is we just have practices once or twice a week. And we play at a Newington Arena. But when we play games, we're kind of like a travel team. There's two major tournaments nationally, one in the spring, one in the fall. The one in the spring is the Disabled Hockey Festival. And the one in the fall is the Blind Hockey Classic, both sponsored by USA Hockey. Not everyone can make every trip. It gets expensive. So you've got, you know, maybe three people from the Brailers go, a few people from the DC team go, and then you kind of merge together to assemble one team. So that's where you get really competitive plays, when you go to these tournaments. And locally, we're mainly practicing. We practice for an hour, once or twice a month, depending on the ice time. Typical practice, you know, the first 5-10 minutes, you know, get warmed up, you know, get a little bit of skating laps in, and then we'll do some drills, standard skating and passing the puck, shooting on net. And then for the last half of practice is what we call the fun part. Everyone's here to play hockey, so we'll scrimmage with as many people as we have. Sometimes only four people show up and we'll play 2-on-2, but you know, that's the fun of it all.
Todd Sweet, again, a forward for the Brailers. I understand you've played hockey, well, most of your life. What does participating in the game mean to you? How important is it to just your way of life?
Oh, it's extremely important. You know, when you play sighted hockey for so many years and then you lose your vision, you assume right off the bat that you're not going to be able to play anymore. So it was extremely important to find out about blind hockey. And so when I heard about it and went down to check it out, and I was asked immediately, hey, you want to join the team? I was like, oh, absolutely. So, yeah. And then it took off from there, and it's been a wonderful experience. I love it. I was missing hockey so much. Anyone who's played hockey before understands that wonderful feeling when you get on that ice and you're skating around, the freedom of it, that it's involved in it. And so it was, it was a wonderful feeling, and to get back on the ice and to play hockey again.
How long were you away from the ice before you got back on with the Brailers?
I'd say maybe 6-7 years.
Mm. Can I ask you, would you mind telling me what happened as your sight began to fade? What was that experience like?
Well, it was a little slow in the beginning. I thought I just needed glasses. And then it went very quickly. Within 6 months, I lost my central vision. It's hard to explain. You know, I say often, you lose your freedom and independence. You know, after I had been to the eye doctor who told me my situation with my vision, you know, 3 days later, I'm down at the motor vehicle, you know, turning in my license. You know, it's a little bit of a shock when you first go through all that. You know, it's obviously quite an adjustment to go through it. So, But I've always said to everyone, you need to go through the process in your life that you have vision loss and that things are going to change, or else you're never going to get to the other side and then let life come at you and enjoy it again.
How did friends, family, acquaintances react when you said, I'm getting back on the ice, I'm going to play hockey?
Well, I guess some people weren't surprised at all. They know how much I love my hockey. And when I meet people I haven't seen in a while, or even people I just met, they're like, you play hockey? And same kind of questions. You know, how do you do that? And it's like, oh, it's just hockey.
Keith Haley, again, a forward for the team and the program organizer for the Brailers. I understand you had an experience similar to Todd's, and you were a member of the U.S. hockey team at one point?
Yes, I played hockey as a young kid. I played high school hockey in Farmington, Connecticut. And, you know, in my 20s, I started losing my vision due to hereditary glaucoma, which takes your peripheral vision first. So it's something that I didn't notice right away. It was like a gradual thing similar to Todd, but it wasn't as drastic after that. It just got progressively worse in my 20s. And I was playing in some men's leagues. I just wasn't seeing the puck as much. So I hung the skate up. Similar story to Todd, as far as, you know, I used to drive, I used to do lots of things. And when you start losing your vision, you get that driver's license taken away, you get your independence taken away, you have to rely on a lot of people to do a lot of things. Hockey was my main sport. You know, I dabbled in others, but, you know, I was a Boston Bruins fan, grew up that way. When you lose something like that, I figured sports, I'm never going to play sports again. And you mentioned adaptive basketball. Once I joined blind hockey, I found about all these other adaptive sports that are out there, skiing, soccer, baseball, they call it beep ball. So when I got back on the ice, I got something back. Enough with losing this, enough with losing that. You know, I got the game of hockey back. I got my confidence back. And from there, it just took off. And we started the Brailers in January of 2017. And we went to our first tournament in Pittsburgh that fall. Then it was called the Blind Hockey Summit, now the Blind Hockey Classic. And then we went to the Disabled Hockey Festival in Chicago, spring of 2018. They were selecting the first U.S. national blind hockey team. And I was fortunate enough to have my name called to attend the first training camp, which was held in Utica, New York, that same year, 2018, in the summertime. And I was lucky enough again to get named to that team. You know, we played against Team Canada several times, and they call it the International Series. We've played up in Toronto, Ottawa, Pittsburgh, and I was on that team right up until last year. Unfortunately, and hiking one afternoon, I broke my ankle. So I'm kind of on injured reserve at this point. So I still skate locally with the Brailers, but I just couldn't skate at the elite level for Team USA, but it was a privilege and an honor to wear that red, white, and blue, that's for sure.
When you decided to get back on the ice, were people supportive of your decision?
Absolutely. You know, my dad lives in Massachusetts. My mom lives here in Connecticut, and both of them drove me that day when I told them what we do with blind hockey is we call them try-it events. As many people know, hockey's an expensive sport. You don't just show up to the field and grab a bat and start playing baseball. You have to get the gear. So I had some gear left over, and I went to the play it again places to get, I wasn't going to go spend $1,000 on brand new gear if this didn't take off. I had no idea. So yeah, my family was very supportive. They were here the first night for that try it event. It was at the Westminster School in Simsbury, Connecticut, one town over from where I live. I said, you know, being one town over, there's no way I can't go and give this a try and see what it's all about. And as they say, the rest is history. You know, I've been playing ever since. And, you know, I have a lot of family still in Massachusetts. And one of the first tournaments I went to in Pittsburgh, they went down in vans. So I had quite the experience through in Pittsburgh. I'm thrilled that everyone's on board with it. I'm thrilled for all the support I've gotten. Because, again, when you don't drive, you need rides places. It's great when you have family or even teammates, as our coach, Dave Hoey, just drove us up to Vermont for a try-it event to help out another team up in Vermont. So it's great to have the support from everyone.
Todd Sweet, did you experience the same kind of support? You mentioned how people reacted when you decided to put on the skates again. Support, was it there for you?
Oh, absolutely. Everybody in my life knows how important hockey is and how much I love it. So you know, when I came home that day from a tryout, I said, oh my God, it's, you know, there's blind hockey, you know, and they asked me if I wanted to be on the team. And everybody was like, totally excited for me. And the next practice, I was, you know, like, well, when is it? You know, what's the time? And everybody was very supportive of needing me to get to the places that I need to do. And same with what Keith was saying, there are times where it's a little difficult to get a ride. So you start asking friends and family and they're, oh yeah, absolutely. And again, with coach, you know, Coach Huey, and he loves the game as much as everyone else. And, you know, everyone's always willing to give me a ride to get there.
So hockey is a rough and tumble sport known for its physical altercations, I guess you could say. There's some sort of a joke. I went to a brawl and a hockey game broke out. how do you stay safe on the ice?
Well, I will say that there is no checking in blind hockey, but there are inadvertent collisions and quite a few of them, as you could imagine, especially with my vision disability. I mentioned that it's peripheral loss. So I could be skating down the ice. There could be a skater just to my left. I don't see anything out of my left eye. I see 80% of my vision out of my right. So I'll turn. And, you know, I think sometimes I'm the only one on the ice. And then, you know, boom, you just slam into somebody. And I've had a couple hard collisions out there. I'm not going to lie. You know, you just sometimes I get caught up in trying to play the game I used to, like the way I used to see. And I kind of forget that I don't see that well anymore. You know, you better turn left and right before you make some sharp movements, but there's definitely some collisions out there. And, you know, Todd can attest to that.
Absolutely.
You both have experience or had experience in hockey prior to the Brailers. Can pretty much anyone join the team, or do you look for people who have had some skating experience or hockey experience?
We look for anybody that has a visual impairment. We also vision sighted volunteers, we call them, that help us on the ice. So we have Coach Dave Hoey, who coaches our team. He's got full sight. Assistant coach Rose Molinaro, she also comes to every practice and just helps us out on the ice, you know, move that puck around, because it's a closed environment. So you're not going to get 20 visually impaired blinded players on the ice in one state. That's why we go to these tournaments. You might only get a handful at one practice and less at another, more at another. So we're always looking to recruit. There's no age limit. And some of these other programs, they start at 5 years old, and we have up to into their 60s. So there's no age limit. We welcome anybody. We'll train them if they've never played. So we have different levels. To play a sport with people that have the same similar disability to you is just fantastic. To get us all together, there's nothing better on a Sunday afternoon. You know, Todd will tell you, if he's the only one on the ice, he still goes to practice.
Absolutely.
Yeah, right. So we'll take anybody. And Todd, I'll say you had some coaching experience. So you know, you've helped a lot of guys, you know, with their skating along the way.
Absolutely. You know, if anybody needs a helping hand, how do I do this? How do I skate? You know, I'm certainly willing, you know, like Keith was saying, we'll take anyone. Doesn't matter whether you've skated for years or it's the first time on the ice. We're certainly happy. We love the game so much. And we know how much an individual that wants to try out for the team is already interested in the game. You know, so we're just as interested in getting them up to speed, how to play the game, how to skate, and we'll spend as much time as we need teaching them and showing them how to skate. That's always been, when I originally started with coaching, they were, you know, tiny little 3, 4, 5 year old kids. You know, you got to teach them how to stand up and how to skate around. And it's amazing how someone that will always say, how do you skate backwards? Like, well, let's just worry about forwards first a little while here. You know, so it's a lot of fun. You get a lot of joy. And when you love the game of hockey, you know, and you got people that want to join, you want to help them out as much as possible. So yeah, that's just as much of a big part as our team is our scrimmages at the last half hour, as Keith was saying earlier.
It sounds like the dynamic, so to speak, the atmosphere, the camaraderie is as important or maybe even more important than the game itself. It sounds like a very supportive and positive experience.
It really is. And what I tell people is when you join the blind hockey community, You know, you're not just joining a sport, but you're joining a family. When we go to these tournaments, it's the same families that you see, because, you know, you've got younger kids in their teens and watching them grow up. 4 years ago, they were 14. Now they're 18 and young men. What we did to pave the way on the U.S. team was to open the door for them to take over. You know, eventually this is going to be a Paralympic sport. And what I tell some of the parents is, your son or daughter is going to be going for a gold medal one day. It's going to happen, whether it's 4 years from now or 8 years from now. But one day to look back and say we had something to do with that is just amazing. And it's more than just hockey. So we tell anybody that has any interest, you don't have to be a Wayne Gretzky. You can come out. As Todd said, we'll train you. And if you just want to come for the camaraderie and, you know, be with other people with a similar disability, just come watch. You don't even have to play. Just come watch and have some fun for a Sunday afternoon.
You mentioned the Paralympics, and I understand you're working to get blind hockey into that competition. Where is that effort right now? How close is the sport to being accepted into the Paralympics?
Well, we were trying for 2026. Obviously, COVID slowed a lot of things down and obviously slowed the growth of blind hockey while nobody was able to get on the ice. But it's my understanding you need 8 countries to petition to become a Paralympic sport. So it started in Canada first. It's been there since the 70s. I don't know why it took so long for us to find out about it, because had I known about blind hockey 20 years ago, I would have been a 20-year veteran right now. You know, Canada, the U.S. are on board. Teams in the U.K., Finland, Sweden, they're popping up overseas. And it's, again, it's spreading the word of blind hockey. Some representatives from Canada have gone over to Europe just for that, to promote the sport. So we're getting there. Right now, the goal, again, we're hoping for 2026. Now it's 2030. We got our fingers crossed for that. But it's just to think of this sport being on that stage, that just it'll be a proud blind hockey moment for all of us when that happens.
So hockey fans in Connecticut remember the NHL team that moved south to Carolina, the Hartford Whalers. So I got to ask you about the name, the Hartford Brailers. How did that come to, is the double entendre on purpose there?
Absolutely. And our founder, Joel Klug, at that first Triad event in Simsbury back in 2017, it was the end of that practice, and he kind of just blurted it out. And I don't know who actually came up with it, but once you hear it, it's a no-brainer. You know, it's people say around the country, it's the best name in blind hockey. We rock the Whaler colors. Which was a little difficult for me at first, being a Bruins fan. You know, I grew up black and gold, but now I wear that Kelly green, blue and white. Those are our colors now. I'm so proud to put that jersey on every time we're on the ice.
Todd Sweet, what's your hope for the team in the future?
Oh, just to keep growing and to get to that point where Keith was saying, as far as the Olympics are concerned, that would be fantastic. Just the way this sport is growing right now, it's growing so fast. I mean, what Keith was referring to before was when this team first started, we were one of the first 5 in the country. And there's many more than that now. And even like you were saying, going into the all over the world, you know, and it's growing so fast. And it's such a wonderful sport to be a part of. And what we were kind of saying before, too, with the camaraderie, that's as much fun as playing the game of hockey, is the joking around the bench and in the locker rooms and having fun. And like I said, you're all together and as one, and it's just a one big happy family. So that's the wonderful part about it.
What's the financial situation? Are there funders, sponsors that help out the teams, the Brailers and other teams around the country?
Locally, some teams, they apply for grants. That helps them with their travel. Individuals can apply for grants to help them with gear or travel to some of these tournaments. Locally, as far as the Brailers, we're working on fundraising now, because these, again, when you're trying to lure new players, the gear is a hefty bill for a parent, you know, if they have a young child. Each tournament, you know, if you're looking at airfare, and, you know, sometimes the rinks aren't close to the airport. So you're looking at Uber costs. So there are a lot of costs that go into, you know, traveling around for blind hockey. So we just do local fundraisers, sometimes on Facebook. Those have been very productive for us. You know, so I don't ever want anybody to not be able to participate because of financial reasons. You know, we want everyone to be able to participate, get back on the ice if you've used to play, or get on the ice if you've never played. So we're always looking for donations just to keep us afloat and help out, you know, newer members to come to our team.
You've got a website people can use to get in touch with you if they've got questions or want to join or have sponsorship suggestions.
Absolutely. Email, we can be found at HartfordBrailers@gmail.com, or on the web, HartfordBrailers.org. And then we have a Facebook page, Hartford Brailers Blind Hockey Club. Our website is up and running, but it's in the, we're, what do you call it, under maintenance at this moment. So, and I'd say in the next month, we should have more information up there, and hopefully some donation tabs if anyone feels like they would like to contribute. I will say it's a fantastic team. It's a fantastic sport, and any support will really be helping out people with low vision and blindness.
Keith Haley is the program organizer, and he skates as a forward for the Hartford Brailers hockey team. Keith, thanks so much for your time today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having us. We really appreciate it.
Todd Sweet, also a member of the team, and he also skates as a forward. Todd Sweet, thank you. We appreciate your sharing with us your experiences as a hockey player.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
Adaptive sports are not the only way to make competitive sports accessible. In New York, the Special Olympics offers unified sports. That's where athletes with different abilities team up to compete. This June, 19 athletes from New York will join the National Special Olympics USA team at the World Games in Berlin, Germany. Two of those athletes join me now on Zoom, Amanda Vito and Martha Pachuta. They are United Golf Partners. Amanda, Martha, welcome to The Full Story.
Thank you so
much.
Thank
you.
Tell me a little bit more, if you would, first about the Unified Sports Program with Special Olympics and how it works. Martha, could you share some information about that with us?
Sure. Unified Sports was developed in order to be more inclusive and provide athletes and our community members an opportunity to compete with athletes with different abilities. And it has been a tremendous program, and golf, which we are going to be competing in, is actually the first sport that identified unified partners in competitions.
Amanda, when did you get involved in golf yourself?
When did I get involved? I don't remember, but I got involved. It wasn't my favorite sport to do, but I enjoyed doing it once I started it, and I just love doing golf now.
It's a challenging sport. I know I tried it twice and I gave it up because I can't do it. But it's a challenge.
Never give up on something you like to do.
Amanda, how did you get involved with Special Olympics to begin with?
So I got involved I was adopted when I was 10 years old, and I never did sports. When I first came from South America, I was adopted from Bogota, Colombia. And so when I went to high school, I got into sports there. And then my mom found somebody was talking to my mom about Special Olympics. And she's like, oh, how do I find her to get into it? So my first time I did Special Olympics was when I was with Jerry Crow. He was an old coach. And we did track. And he's like, oh, wow, she can run fast. Let's keep her. So that's how I got involved. My mom found it through a friend that got me involved. So, yeah, that's how I got involved.
How many athletes participate in the unified teams? Martha?
There's unified teams in many, many sports. So I would say that there are 30,000, more than 30,000 athletes and unified partners that participate in New York State. So there's quite a huge contingent in terms of their participation.
According to the website, your website, the program has helped to reduce bullying, I understand, and change perspectives on negative stereotypes. How so?
Well, Amanda, I'm going to let you kind of maybe take that over.
Sure, Amanda.
When I first started doing Special Olympics, I usually got like bullied, and you know, people looked at me different. But to me, people who bully people, it hurts. It bothers other people, and that's not right. We should never do that in Special Olympics or anywhere you are. It's wrong and not the right time to do that. And I don't like people getting bullied.
I can share that my brother participated in Special Olympics in Connecticut a number of years ago. He's 70 now, so it was about 40 years ago that he was involved, which it was a great program there. So this is, for me personally, this is a very interesting program as well. Martha, can you weigh in on that in terms
sure.
of negative stereotypes?
Yeah, so Unified Sports was an opportunity to be able to provide education and really teach acceptance into our communities. And because of that reason, you have been able to see a decline in the way that individuals may have been treated, especially in the school systems and in their communities, prior to the mission of unified and inclusion that came around, and the acceptance and the education has really turned people's perspectives around in terms of what their abilities and what they're capable of doing in their communities and in the workplace. It's been profound.
So as I mentioned before, Amanda, you'll be going to Berlin, Germany to compete
yes.
in the world competition. What are you looking forward to? This sounds very exciting.
So this is my first time going to World Games, mm-hmm. and I've never been to Berlin. So it's going to be awesome. We're going to do great, and we're going to do our best and meet all different people out there. So I'm excited to start a journey.
And again, both you and Martha will be competing
yes.
in the golf competition, right?
Yes. We're doing alternate shots. So, yeah, she's my partner.
Mm-hmm. And you've been in Special Olympics for about 20 years, I understand. And you've competed not only in golf, but in other sports as well.
Yes, I have. I've competed in track, swimming, bocce, basketball, mainly all the sports.
Did you like them all? Were you...
Now golf is my favorite. yeah, I love golf now. I used to love track, but I can't run that much anymore. So
that's a good transition, track to golf. Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Can you tell me a little bit more how the golf game is played? You mentioned alternate shots. How does that work?
So how that goes is how do I explain this? So both of us will take, like, if I go first and I hit the ball, then she'll hit the ball. We take turns hitting the ball and stuff, so that's what it is.
And Martha, you've been to international competitions before, correct?
In 2011, I was fortunate enough to have the opportunity to play unified golf with a different partner in Greece in 2011. So I am anxious and excited to have the opportunity to do it again, because experiencing that with an athlete that you work with, not only as a coach, as a partner, as a friend, sharing that experience with them is something that is just indescribable.
So you and Amanda are you're a coach, you're a friend, and a partner with Amanda. How did you get together? How did the two of you meet and become partners?
Well, actually, Amanda and I have known each other for probably 15 years or more because of our involvement in Special Olympics. And as far as golf goes, Amanda initially started golfing with her father, and he was the one that really got her, you know, connected with the game. But then my involvement in the golf program in New York State, they reached out at some point, and we began participating in different events and fundraisers and things through golf. And then the opportunity for national games that they just had in Florida, to have Amanda actually was assigned to a different unified partner, and I was their coach. And then circumstances happened, and I actually stepped into the role as her partner rather than just her coach. And because of that opportunity, then the opportunity to participate in the World Games as Special Olympics USA came about, and we are both very excited and working very hard to be able to perform our best and represent Special Olympics USA as best we can.
Yeah, what a great opportunity. How did you first get involved in Special Olympics? I understand you've been connected with it for something like four decades.
Over 40 years. Mm. So it's been a long time. And basically, this is the story I tell people. I was an avid athlete in high school, loved sports, and I figured I was just going to take the sports path by going to school and becoming a phys ed teacher. Well, my guidance counselor told me that was not a good plan. There's very few jobs, and it's a very difficult. So I happened to have a program in my high school, which was not common. There was a special education program in our school, and my counselor suggested that maybe I should volunteer into the classroom, and I did, and I absolutely loved it. So I became a special education teacher. But then I found out that special education also had sports. So now here I was able to connect both passions, and I have been hooked on Special Olympics ever since. I am now retired as a teacher, but Special Olympics is still strong in my daily activities.
You've had quite a few roles with the organization with Special Olympics, haven't you?
Yes. Not only am I a coach, but I'm also involved in coaches education and coaches training. And I, you know, help out a lot. And I'm a sports director for a few of the sports in New York State and some of the events that we have locally.
As far as the specific sports, you've been involved in more than golf. And do you have a favorite?
Well, in the education system, our class, you know, we were involved with their training and education throughout. So in the beginning, I spent probably involved in just about every sport you can think of. But as time progressed, I became specialized in three areas, golf, swimming, and alpine skiing. So those three are the ones that I focus on the most.
Let's talk about golf a little bit more, if we could. Amanda, how are you and Martha preparing for the competition there? Are you practicing a lot? What are you doing in the meantime?
So we are doing, I don't know if you've ever heard of the Simonator. It's a place where you hit, there's a big screen, and you hit golf balls. You hit a ball, and it shows you your how far it goes and how distance and stuff. So that's how we've been practicing. So we've been using that.
Do you think that helps you get better at the sport?
Well, it's helping my game. It's helping me how to do better, and it's helping me how to, you know, hit farther and stuff. Yeah, so it is helping me.
How about you, Martha?
Absolutely. So, you know, being from Western New York, during the winter, we don't have some of the advantages of some of the other southern states, so we don't really have golf year-round, so we have to figure out ways in which we can keep our skills. And so we've been fortunate enough, and we've had an individual out connect with us, Brian Jacobs Golf Academy here in Rochester, and he has basically kind of adopted Amanda and I, and is helping us to reach our goals and preparing us for this great opportunity. So during the winter months, we spend practicing on the simulator and working with our instructor, our PGA instructor, Brian Jacobs, and he's doing a great job encouraging and working with us to allow us to reach our full potential. And then, of course, Amanda, she's a workout queen. So besides her golf, she works out. And that's something that Special Olympics has really encouraged athletes to be fit. We have a huge health and fitness programs. And so it all encompasses our athletes in order for them to be the best that they can be, both in sports and as human being and as individuals.
Are you in touch with other members of the team that will be going to Berlin for the competition? Social media, is that one way that you keep in touch with other folks?
Right, absolutely. And all the individuals that had been nominated for consideration traveled to Texas just a month or so ago. And so we were able to meet the entire golf team and other participants in other sports, but we got time to face-to-face and meet everyone individually that will be attending as part of the Special Olympics USA. And then they just basically came out with the official announcement January 19th. And everybody one now is not under consideration. Now everybody has been selected for their participation in this event. And we will continue to work with on Zoom meetings and things like that. So that's the big difference between what I experienced in 2011 and what we're going to be able to experience now, and the camaraderie and the amount of time that we can communicate with one another. It's just fantastic now.
Have you been able to make some new friends, Amanda, with all the contact with the folks who are going to be on the team?
Oh, yeah. I'm a friendly person.
Well, that's good to hear. Again, thank you both so much for being with us for the program today. Been talking with Amanda Vito and Martha Picciuta. They are Unified Golf Partners, part of the Special Olympics program in New York, and they will both be heading to Berlin, Germany this June as part of the team from the United States competing in the National Special Olympics competition, the USA team at the World Games. Again, thank you both, Martha. Thank you, and Amanda, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
Been listening to an encore presentation of The Full Story. And that's it for our program today, produced by Fatou Sangare, Sophie Camizzi, and senior producer Dan Lopez. I'm Tom Kuser. Thank you for listening to The Full Story.